The core story of Numbers chapter 4 is what is typically called the second Levite census. Now, the information is very straightforward, so we're not going to dwell here very long, and the census differs from the earlier Levite census that God himself performed, primarily in that this new census, the age range was to be counted from 30 years old to 50 years old, a very narrow 20-year age range. Now, remember, the first Levite census counted what? 30 days old, 1 month old, on up. And the reason, although I admit it's not specifically stated, probably for specifying this particular age range is because of the heavy duty nature of the work that involves carrying all these sanctuary objects and pieces and doing guard duty. So these needed to be mature people. And the thought is that these men must be very responsible and emotionally mature so as to perform their jobs with absolute dedication, and they must be physically able to lift these heavy objects and tote them through the wilderness, as well as defending the sanctuary in hand-to-hand combat, if that's what had to happen. So, open your Bibles to Numbers chapter 4. We're going to read the whole chapter. Page 149 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. 149. Numbers chapter 4. Adonai said to Moses and Aaron, take a census of the descendants of Kehat, who are among the descendants of Levi, by clans and families, all those from 30 to 50 years old. These will enter the corps doing the work in the tent of meeting. And here is how the descendants of Kehat are to serve in the tent of meeting and to deal with these especially holy things. When the time comes to break camp, Aaron is to go in with his sons, take down the curtain which serves as a screen, and cover the Ark of the Testimony with it. And on that, they are to place a covering of fine leather, and on top of that, spread an all-blue cloth. Then they are to insert the carrying poles. And on the table of showbread, they are to spread a blue cloth and place on it its dishes, the incense pans, offering bowls and pitchers. The perpetual bread is to remain on the table. They are to spread on these things a scarlet cloth, cover them with a covering of fine leather, and insert the poles. They are to take a blue cloth and cover the menorah for the light, its lamps, its tongs, its trays, and the jars used to add oil to it. They are to wrap it and all of its accessories in fine leather and place them on a carrying frame. And on the gold altar, they are to spread a blue cloth and cover it with a covering of fine leather and insert its carrying poles. They are to take all the utensils they use when serving in the sanctuary and put them in a blue cloth, cover them with fine leather, place them on a carrying frame. And after removing the greasy ashes from the altar, they are to spread a purple cloth over it, place on it all the utensils required for the altar service, the fire pans, meat hooks, shovels, basins, and other utensils for the altar. Then they are to spread it over it a fine leather covering and insert its carrying poles. When Aaron and his sons have finished covering the holy furnishings and all of the holy utensils, when the camp is about to move forward, then the descendants of Kehat are to come and carry them, but they're not to touch the holy things so that they won't die. These things are the responsibility of the descendants of Kehat in the tent of meeting. Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, is to be responsible for the oil for the light, the fragrant incense, the continuing grain offering, and the anointing oil. He is to be in charge of the entire tabernacle, everything in it, including the sanctuary and its furnishings. Adonai said to Moses and Aaron, do not cut off the clan of Kehat from among the Levites. Rather, do this for them, so that they will live and not die. When they approach the especially holy things, Aaron and his sons are to go in, and you are to assign each one his task. But the descendants of Kehat are not to go in and look upon the holy things as they are being covered. If they do, they'll die. Adonai said to Moses, take a census of the descendants of Gershon, also by clans and families. Count all those between 30 and 50 years old, all who will enter the corps doing the work of serving in the tent of meeting. The Gershon families are to be responsible for serving and for transporting loads. They are to carry the curtains of the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, its covering, the fine leather covering above it, the screen for the entrance to the tent of meeting, the tapestries for the courtyard, and the screen for the entrance to the courtyard by the tabernacle and around the altar, along with the ropes and all the utensils they need for their service. They are to do the work connected with these things. Aaron and his sons are to supervise all the work of the Gershon clan in transporting loads and in serving, and to assign them who is to carry what. This is how the Gershon families are to serve in the tent of meeting, and they are to be under the direction of Ithamar, the son of Aaron the priest. As for the descendants of Merari, take a census by clans and families of all those between 30 and 50 years old, all who will be in the corps doing the work of serving in the tent of meeting. Their service for the tent of meeting will be to carry the frames and the crossbars, posts and sockets of the tabernacle, all the posts for the surrounding courtyard with their sockets, tent pegs, ropes, other accessories, everything having to do with their service. You are to assign particular loads to specific persons by name. This is how the Merari families are to serve in the tent of meeting, directed by Ithamar, the son of Aaron the priest. Moses, Aaron, and the community leaders took a census of the descendants of Kohath by their clans and families, all those between 30 and 50 years old, who were part of the corps serving in the tent of meeting. And registered by their families, they numbered 2,750. These are the ones counted from the Kohath families of all those serving in the tent of meeting, whom Moses and Aaron enumerated in keeping with the order given by Adonai through Moses. The census of the descendants of Gershon by their clans and families, all those between 30 and 50 years old who were part of the corps serving in the tent of meeting, yielded 2,630 registered by clans and families. These are the ones counted from the families of the descendants of Gershon of all those serving in the tent of meeting, whom Moses and Aaron enumerated in keeping with the order given by Adonai. The census of the families of the descendants of Merari by their clans and families, all those between 30 and 50 years old who were part of the corps serving in the tent of meeting yielded 3,200 registered by their family. These are the ones counted from the families of the descendants of Merari whom Moses and Aaron enumerated in keeping with the order given by Adonai through Moses. The census of the Levites, whom Moses, Aaron, and the leaders of Israel enumerated by their clans and families, all those between 30 and 50 years old who were part of those working to serve and working to carry loads in the tent of meeting, yielded a total of 8,580 persons. According to Adonai's order, they were appointed by Moses, each one to his specific service or work. They were also enumerated as Adonai had ordered Moses. You know, tribalism is the culture of the Bible. And until we can digest that and deal with it, we're going to miss a lot of what's happening in the many narratives that shape scriptures. In our Western civilization, the ways of tribalism are usually either not known to us at all, or they're very misunderstood. It's important to grasp that tribalism is morally neutral. It's not good nor bad in itself. Tribalism is a very natural societal structure. And it worked particularly well for an ancient world. Tribalism was the dominant societal structure worldwide until medieval times in Europe, because it was based on familial ties, and the bond of blood has always been instinctive and intuitive and very powerful for mankind. By medieval times, European societal structure became transformed by a combination of religious and national identity. Thus, tribalism began to take a back seat in that part of the world. In the late 17th and early 18th centuries, another transformation took hold in Europe and the New World, as guided by the leaders and philosophers of the period now known as the Enlightenment. That was when religious identity was brought into question, and it was replaced by atheistic viewpoints and this desire for a purely secular government and societal structure that was based on economics rather than on common beliefs or in hereditary ties. The rub is that the Enlightenment also tended to dissolve family ties. Family ties, of course, are at the heart of tribalism. And thus, today, Western societies have become collections and loose networks of small family units that anthropologists call nuclear families. This is kind of the concept of a family as generally consisting of a mother and father and their immediate children. The term nuclear family is not referring to the invention of the atom bomb. However, it does provide us with a pretty good illustration. Just as an atom is in its natural state, it has a center called a nucleus with electrons and protons orbiting around it. The new modern Western family unit is akin to an atom that's been stripped of its electrons and protons, and all that remains is that nucleus. Within this new definition of family in the West, legal rights are usually limited to the two-generation relationship. Grandparents are legally considered outsiders. Aunts and uncles and cousins now, in most instances, are practically distant relatives who have only the most minor tie to any particular nuclear family. And of course, we are all aware that an even further evolution of family relationship is well underway in the West that negates the need for long-term commitment or bonds among individuals, or even for the presence of a mother and a father as head of a family, or for the desirability of blood ties. Essentially, the newest modern era social unit that's being advocated and legislated is an ever-widening, in this ever-widening circle in the developed world, is much more akin to a pack mentality, whereby mostly unrelated and uncommitted individuals choose to band together for some brief time to satisfy an immediate or intermediate need of companionship, or maybe of group protection, or maybe some perceived economic advantage. In other words, we're so far removed from the concept of tribalism that it's near impossible for our minds to even comprehend it. So we immediately tend to see tribalism as negative or as a backward institution. Might surprise you to know, however, that despite the best efforts of the UN and the world's most powerful governments, most of the world today is still tribal. That's one of the many sources of clashes that we see between Islam and Judeo-Christianity concerns a tribal mentality based purely on family and faith versus a Western-style society that revolves around individualism and moral relativism, with family ties completely secondary. Where I'm leading you is that to understand the Bible, we must understand tribal structure and tribal mentality. And the most influential societal unit within a tribal culture is the clan. A clan, being a large extended family, actually, often has its own economy, even its own government if it's grown big enough. A clan's identity invariably goes back to the founder of that clan. Loyalties of the members of the clan are inviolable. It can stretch back for centuries. Further, it is usual that a few clans become dominant within a tribe. Others become inferior, subservient, even die out, or more typically, they just get absorbed by the more dominant ones. Thus, when we hear of the term tribal warfare today, and in ancient times, more often than not, what was occurring is not a battle between two tribes, but rather fighting among the clans that make up a single tribe. In tribalism, there's a never-ending battle for clan superiority. Within tribalism, the status of each clan is everything. And underlying the text of our Bible is this tribal struggle for dominance. Keep this in mind, especially as we study Torah and the books of the Old Testament, and it shows up front and center here in Numbers. In Numbers 4, the first clan of the Levites to be counted in this new census is the Kohathites. Now, this is different from the first census because in the prior census, the clan of Gershon was counted first because Gershon was the firstborn. The probable reason that the Kohathites are given priority status is because this clan transported the most sacred, therefore the most dangerous object. Further, Aaron and Moses belonged to the clan of Kohath. So this lent significant tribal status to the Kohathites. Now, as regards tribal status among the various Levite clans, we're not going to get into it right now. I just want you to know that over time, the order of preeminence among the various Levite clans would change a little bit. Even some duties would shift from laymen to Levites, then from Levites to priests. This greatly bothers some Bible scholars for the fear that information we discover in the later books of the Old Testament sometimes paints a little different picture of the priesthood are errors or serious revisions. Personally, I find that all that makes the scriptures all the more believable. Because even though Israel was slowly developing a different culture from the rest of the world, they didn't start living on a different planet. Over the centuries, everything from changing weather patterns to technology, to fluctuating societal demographics, to more simple, tangible things like the decommissioning of the wilderness tabernacle and the replacement of it with a permanent temple, even what nation might be ruling over Israel at any given time, Assyria, Babylon, the Romans, all this. It makes it such that the precise way that rituals and ceremonies could even be performed and who did them changed. If we were to read that these things never changed over a period of 14 or 15 centuries, from the moment they were introduced, it just wouldn't even pass the smell test, because that's just not real life. For instance, people today can argue over what is proper kosher food regulations. But in reality, nobody can follow the kosher food laws exactly as laid out in the Torah. You know why? There's no temple, and there's no priesthood. So the best we can do is to do the best we can do under the circumstances. There are no fields, there are no croplands that I'm aware of in America that are regulated by means of the Shabbat and the Jubilee laws. Therefore, what grows on that land isn't regulated the way that is scripturally kosher. In fact, very little food grown in Israel follows the law in such a way as to be honestly considered biblically kosher. We can argue over exactly how to celebrate the various required biblical feasts. But at least for three of them, it requires pilgrimages to the Holy Land in order to be efficacious. We can't do them exactly as stated, no matter what. Because the main point wasn't going to Jerusalem. It was going to Jerusalem to the temple to worship and to sacrifice, not just visit the city like tourists. Some rituals, like the water libation ceremony, which could be done to a degree, are required to be done atop the great altar. Doesn't exist. See, these are just a few examples that today's Jews face, and I think we face as believers, in attempting to cope with biblical regulations that, due to circumstances, most of them beyond our control, just can't be accomplished as laid down, no matter how much we want to. And so did the Israelites face this kind of scenario as the years rolled on over Mount Sinai, after Mount Sinai. So don't let some of these changes that we'll find, even as we move from Numbers to Deuteronomy, throw you off. These changes in circumstance weren't a surprise to God, and the whole point to the exact nature of the required holy rituals revolved around teaching and obedience, not some magical or mystical nature of hand movements and the use of golden bowls instead of copper bowls, or the power of incense burning, or whether one kind of food is necessarily healthier than another kind of food, and all this. And as we move into verse 5, we find that the sacred objects and the furnishings of the tabernacle were too holy to be directly handled by the Levites. So they had to be wrapped. They had to be packed up by the priests. Then it was all transferred to the care of the Kohathites for transport. You know those pods? All right. The priests put them in the pods and Levites carried the pods. All right. That's how it worked. For example, when we see that inner veil of the sanctuary, it had to be taken down by the priest. Then that veil was actually used to wrap the Ark of the Covenant. And then over that, a waterproof layer, probably of porpoise skins, was added. And then the final layer of the package was a special pure blue cloth. And then poles were inserted to carry that cargo. The priests accomplished all this preparation before they turned it over to the Kohathites, who were allowed only to handle the sacred object by means of touching the carrying poles, no other part. In fact, later in the Bible, we'll read of a couple of different incidents. When the ark was being transported, and it looked like it was going to fall over. So some poor unauthorized person reached up to steady it. What happened? Dead. Next, the table of showbread was to have a blue cloth laid over it, upon which the various utensils that were used in the ritual service were to be laid upon the table, plus a fresh group of the 12 loaves of bread that it was designed to hold. Then a covering of crimson, red cloth wrapped up the whole thing over that one, another waterproof layer, probably again porpoise skins. The table had rings built into it, just like the Ark of the Covenant. So poles then slid through the rings, and the Kohathites grabbed hold of the poles and carried it. The next most important item was the menorah, and various implements used to tend to it. Those were all wrapped up in a blue cloth. Over that, some more porpoise skins were placed to keep it dry. Then it was laid on a special wooden frame for it to be transported. In verse 11, the golden altar of incense that stood in front of the parochet, the inner veil, between the holy place and the Holy of Holies, it had a blue cloth spread over it. It was covered yet again with more waterproof covering. Then the remaining service items and vessels that were used inside the tabernacle were all wrapped in a blue cloth, more skins over them for maximum protection. Well, now that the priest packed up all the items from inside the tent of meeting, the text now turns our attention to the things outside of the tent. It begins, of course, with the altar of burnt offering. And after the ashes, they call them greasy ashes, are removed from the altar, a purple cloth is placed over it. And upon that, all the items used to service and care for the altar, like the fire tongs and the blood basins and all this, they're placed on top, and then on top of that, more dolphin skins were laid. And all the sacred items now having been covered and prepared by the priest, this is all turned over now to the moving company, Kohath and his clan, for them to carry them around. None of these items, not even their coverings, could be touched by the Kohathites. Verse 16 tells us that the priest, Eleazar, is the supervisor over the Levites as regards the transporting of all these sacred objects. Further, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, telling them that the supervision over the Kohathites must be total, because their job is so dangerous. Nothing can be left to chance. One glance at an uncovered piece of holy furniture, that could be death to the onlooker. We begin to see now why God insisted that only men from age 30 to 50 should do this task. Younger men would just be too cavalier, perhaps, in their duties and find themselves dead and God's holiness assaulted. Well, now the clans of Gershon are to be recounted. And the count included only those between the ages, only males, between the ages of 30 and 50. And it's this particular age group that's to deal with the items that have already been called out before. Primarily the various coverings of the sacred tent. And these men are to be under the direct supervision of another son of Aaron. His name is Ithamar. Similar orders are given in verse 29 for the clans of Merari. And they're also under the supervision of Ithamar. And starting in verse 34, we get the result of this latest count. We find out the Kohathites had 2,750 men in the 30 to 50 year age range. The Gershonites, 2,630. Those of Merari, 3,200 total, 8,580 men. Now it's interesting how we watch a foundational principle of God, dividing, electing, and separating, occur in so many parallel ways. God divided and separated the entire population of the world into two groups, Hebrews and Gentiles. These Hebrews, now the nation of Israel, were also divided into two groups, the 12 tribes and the tribe of Levi. Now we see the tribe of Levi divided into two groups, the priests and the non-priests, called the Levites. And in this process of dividing, electing, and separating, absolutely no merit is stated for why one line of people was chosen and given a higher status than another line of people. None. There wasn't anything inherently special about Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob. There wasn't anything inherently special about the tribe of Levi. There was nothing special about Aaron's descendants. God, for his own good reason, elected them. He made a decision. About the best that can be said for the person or the group that was divided away from the others and assigned a special level of holiness above all the others is that that person or group accepted the offer. They said yes. And my friends, that is the pattern for those of us today who are set apart as saved believers. We haven't lived a better life. By God's grace, we were offered salvation, came upon the back of Yeshua, and we just said, yes. By accepting it, we were assigned a special level of righteousness and holiness above all others on this planet. Our salvation in Yeshua is as much a mystery as to why me, as it must have been to Abraham and everybody else. Why Isaac and not Ishmael? Why Jacob and not Esau? Why the tribe of Levi? Why not one of the other tribes? Why the line of Aaron instead of one of his brothers? We don't know. We're not told. Israel is a completely set apart nation for God. The rest of the world is not, and that's the deal. And as such, Israelites, today we'd say Jews, are born into a special higher status than you or I as Gentiles were born into. The tribe of Levi was given a holy status, a notch above the rest of Israel. The priestly line of Aaron was given a yet higher holy status above all the other families and clans that made up the Levites. And the clan of Eleazar, a son of Aaron, was given the highest holy status among the line of priests. We saw last week that the Levite clan of Kohath was given a slightly higher status above the other clans of non-priest Levites. There's a couple more principles woven into Numbers that we'll find Paul expound upon in the New Testament, particularly in 1 Corinthians 12 and 13. And one is that Yahweh demands order and not chaos. Therefore, he creates hierarchies of authority. Why? Because it's his pattern. We learn in the Bible that even heaven itself is built on hierarchies. So naturally, the physical world follows suit to the level it's able to do so. All human life has worth. But God gives higher and lower worth to various humans for his purposes, just as he gives higher and lower status to his spiritual servants, the angels and the cherubim. There is a variety of service to the Lord available to be done. There's plenty to go around. But it's all for the purpose of serving the same God. Listen to Paul briefly in 1 Corinthians 12:4. Now there are varieties of gifts, but if they're of the same Spirit. And there are varieties of ministries, but it's the same Lord. And there are varieties of effects, but the same God who works all things and all persons. But to each one is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. And just as Israel is a congregation with God-ordained structure, so is the believing body of disciples of Yeshua to be a divinely ordered structure. Listen to Paul again in 1 Corinthians 12:28. And God has appointed in the church, first, apostles, second, prophets, third, teachers, then miracles, then gifts of healing and helps and administrations and various kinds of tongues. All are not apostles, are they? All aren't prophets, are they? All aren't teachers, are they? All aren't workers of miracles, are they? All do not have gifts of healing, do they? All do not speak with tongues, do they? All don't interpret, do they? See, this second principle that sort of interlaces with the first is that it takes different skills and different jobs working together to perform different functions to form an entire and complete community. Naturally, we find this principle addressed by Paul in the New Testament because it is just the Torah carried forward in light of the advent of Messiah Yeshua. See, God spoke to Moses, who took those instructions to Aaron, who took those instructions to the priests, who took them to the people. As there were a variety of tasks to be done, there was also a variety of offices established to oversee them. The priests were created to be the keepers and teachers of the law. The Levites were the police. They were servants to the priests. Even among the priests and the Levites, jobs were carefully broken down into finite units. Some tended to certain parts of the sacred furniture. Others carried plants and tent pegs. Others performed guard duty, so on. Yes, and some held higher status than others. But each has a critical role to play, and no role was menial, except in the eyes of men. Such as this is the body of Christ today. No one is set aside. Nobody's given a pass. Everyone has a duty. Not one believer ever got passed over for a spiritual gift. It's never happened. The one that chooses to ignore his assignment, that one chooses to sit on the sidelines, that doesn't mean that he or she doesn't have a purpose awaiting them. See, we can complain all we want that the church is maybe broken, malfunctioning. We can point to what everybody does wrong, but at least they do. At least they stand up at the plate and take a swing. The system that God set up for his people to follow is not about 10% doing and 90% observing. Worship and walking with God is a contact sport. It's dangerous. You can get hurt. If you're not battered and bruised to some degree by now, then you've been sitting it out way too long. Get your uniform dirty. Get in the game. See, this kind of passivity that I'm describing, that wasn't even tolerated in Moses' day, nor in David's day, nor in Yeshua's day. We shouldn't think that God is going to allow us to get away with it with no repercussions. Now, let's start talking now about Numbers chapter 5. Numbers chapter 5 is another one of those ventures into scripture that at first glance seems as though it's just repetition at work, so there's not much additional to gain. But let me say before we read this Torah portion that this is much less repetition than it is progressive revelation. There is so much to gain from even the first couple of paragraphs that we could be a month in this chapter and only barely scratch its surface. We assuredly aren't going to spend that much time in chapter 5. But I want you to be aware that it is that significant. If we were going to name this chapter, it would be Cleansing the Camp of the Unclean. Now that the tabernacle is part of every Israelite's daily life, and therefore God's presence is, long as that tabernacle's there, his presence among them is assured, it's necessary that the sacredness of the entire tabernacle area, the tent, its courtyard, be kept free from impurity, not get defiled. We've discussed the subject of clean and unclean, of holy and common, but since it's been a while, we'll review those items as we go along. Just be aware that clean and unclean, holy and common are not two different ways of saying the same thing. They denote something a little bit different. It's always best to read an entire chapter as a whole so that the context is clearly established. So let's do that, and then we might reread some portions as we go through our lesson. To open your Bibles to chapter 5 of Numbers, which is page 151. Adonai said to Moses, order the people of Israel to expel from the camp everyone with sarat, everyone with a discharge who is, and whoever is unclean because of touching a corpse. Both male and female you must expel. Put them outside the camp so that they won't defile their camp, where I live among you. The people of Israel did this and put them outside the camp. The people of Israel did what Adonai had said to Moses. And Adonai said to Moses, tell the people of Israel, when a man or a woman commits any kind of sin against another person and thus breaks faith with Adonai, he incurs guilt. He has to confess the sin which he's committed. He must make full restitution for his guilt, add 20%, and give it to the victim of his sin. But if the person has no relative to whom restitution can be made for the guilt, then what is given in restitution for guilt will belong to Adonai, that is, to the priest, in addition to the ram of atonement through which atonement is made for him. Every contribution which the people of Israel consecrate and present to the Kohen, the priest, will belong to him. Anything an individual consecrates will be his own to allocate among the priests, but what a person gives to the priest will belong to him. Adonai said to Moses, tell the people of Israel, if a man's wife goes astray and is unfaithful to him, that is, if another man goes to bed with her without her husband's knowledge so that she becomes impure secretly and there's no witness against her and she was not caught in the act, then if a spirit of jealousy comes over him and he is jealous of his wife and she has become impure, or for that matter, if the spirit of jealousy comes over him and he is jealous of his wife and she has not become impure, he is to bring his wife to the priest, along with the offering for her, 2 quarts of barley flour on which he has not poured olive oil or put frankincense, because it is a grain offering for jealousy, a grain offering for remembering, for recalling guilt to mind. The priest will put her, will bring her forward and place her before Adonai. The priest will put holy water in a clay pot, and then the priest will take some of the dust on the floor of the tabernacle and put it in the water. The priest will place the woman before Adonai, unbind the woman's hair, and put the grain offering for remembering in her hands, the grain offering for jealousy. And while the priest has in his hand the water of embitterment and cursing, the priest will make her swear by saying to her, "If no man has gone to bed with you, if you have not gone astray to make yourself unclean while under your husband's authority, then be free from this water of embitterment and cursing. But if you, in fact, have gone astray while under your husband's authority and become unclean because some man other than your husband has gone to bed with you, then the Kohen is to make the woman swear with an oath that includes a curse. The priest will say to the woman, 'May Adonai make you an object of cursing and condemnation among your people by making your private parts shrivel up and your abdomen swell up. May this water that causes the curse go into your inner parts and make your abdomen swell and your private parts shrivel up.' And the woman is to respond, 'Amen, amen.' The priest is to write these curses on a scroll, wash them off into the water of embitterment, and make the woman drink the water of embitterment and cursing. The water of cursing will enter her and become bitter. Then the priest is to remove the grain offering for jealousy from the woman's hand, wave the grain offering before Adonai, and bring it to the altar. The priest is to take a handful of the grain offering as its reminder portion and make it go up in smoke on the altar. Afterwards, he's to make the woman drink the water. When he has made her drink the water, then if she is unclean and she has been unfaithful to her husband, the water that causes the curse will enter her and become bitter so that her abdomen swells and her private parts shrivel up, and the woman will become an object of cursing among her people. But if the woman is not unclean, but clean, then she will be innocent. She'll have children. This is the law for jealousy. When either a wife under her husband's authority goes astray and becomes unclean, or the spirit of jealousy comes over a husband and he becomes jealous of his wife, then he is to place the woman before Adonai, and the priest is to deal with her in accordance with all of this law. The husband will be clear of guilt, but the wife will bear the consequences of her guilt." That's an interesting chapter. Jehovah says that the following people are not welcome to reside among his people. Then he gives and he divides them up into three categories. In Hebrew, these categories are persons who are, one, zara, means they're suffering from zarat, a skin disease. Two, a person with zav, which means a discharge from their genital organs. And third, anyone who is tamei nefesh, means unclean because they've touched a dead body. Now, basically, these are three very serious kinds of ritual impurity. Each one of them demands a period of 7 days of ritual cleansing after it's been determined that the condition that is the cause of the impurity isn't present anymore. And whether male or female, these ritually unclean people must be removed from the congregation of Israel set outside the camp. Understand what that means. It means excommunication. And once the ritual impurity is cleansed, if it ever is, then that person can resume his or her life within the community. But until that time, that person is separated apart from everybody else. And usually the excommunicated lived in caves or tents just outside of the village or the city. Verse 3 states that the reason for this severe method of dealing with these unfortunate folks is so that their unclean state doesn't defile others within the camp of Israel. And because in the midst of the camp of Israel, that's where God dwells. So no impure thing can be near him. And verse 4 says, Israel obeyed Jehovah in these instructions. Now, probably of all the subjects we've ever discussed here, clean and unclean, which also includes the category of kosher and not kosher, is the most difficult to grasp, I think, for a 21st century Western mind. particularly for a person schooled in a traditional church setting, where pastors and teachers have done a, let's just say, a less than thorough job in explaining all that it means, and what it might have to do with us, modern believers. And typically, as most of you are aware, the entire concept is just dismissed as utterly irrelevant to modern Christians, and so it's a waste of breath to even address it. Now, ritual uncleanness, which is the same thing as ritual impurity, was and remains a very serious issue for those who worship the God of Israel, but it is discussed in detail in the Old Testament as opposed to the New. Why is this? Let me answer that question with a question. Why would Yeshua, or why would the apostles, repeat everything that was long established as the foundation for proper worship and obedience to God? We have to remember, Yeshua is the Word. He didn't have to revalidate his own word. He didn't come to defend what had been settled for 13 centuries. What makes ritual impurity so serious is that it is contagious. It is spiritually contagious. When someone was put outside the camp with Zarat, skin disease, it's usually mistranslated as leprosy. Leprosy didn't even exist among the Israelites until after Babylon. It was not so that somebody else didn't contract that skin disease per se. Rather, they did it because a person with Zarat threatened to defile others in a spiritual way, which would, of course, then deny them access to God. So to the Israelites, a skin disease or a genital discharge or coming into contact with a dead body, among other things, all amounted to approximately the same thing. Separation from God and from the community of God for anywhere from a few hours to a few days to forever. And frankly, that is exactly what it was meant to demonstrate. See, the problem was that a ritually unclean person presented a danger to himself or herself, because if they came too near God in that condition, they could be destroyed. And they were a danger to the community because uncleanness was transmissible. An unclean person could transmit their uncleanness to objects like dishes and pots, or even a chair they sat on or a bed they lay on. And then once that object became unclean, it could transmit uncleanness, and so on and so forth. Now, I know that many of you feel like such talk of becoming unclean from touching someone or something ought to be about some deep jungle backward tribe in New Guinea or Australia, but certainly not the people of Jehovah. And on the surface, this sounds like magic and sorcery and superstition, but this is a good time to remind you that while every one of these laws were real and absolute, and God has fully intended they be obeyed, they were also simultaneously a physical demonstration and a learning tool designed to progressively reveal the deepest and the most critical spiritual truths. I had a wonderful discussion one time with Dr. Robert McGee, the author of Search for Significance, about the nature of spiritual truth and how to express these truths in words. And we agreed that at the absolute best, words or word pictures or drawings or illustrations, they all fell far short of accurately communicating to humans the infinite depths or the heavenly heights of God's laws and principles. And the reason this is so is simple, but it's profound. Jehovah is spirit. We are flesh. The spirit world may have boundaries. I don't know. But whatever they are, they're so enormous as compared to the severe limitations of our physical boundaries. But it's probably best to oversimplify and say, as far as we know, the spiritual world has no limits. Regardless of whether we're saved or unsaved, as a human being, we live in a four-dimensional universe of length, width, height, and time. A human being, whether it be a thought or spoken or written, we are confined to describing only things which operates in this four-dimensional universe. Spirit is a fifth or other dimension, if you would. It's a thing that's outside of our ability to grasp or accurately define. Spirit is not the first four dimensions plus another one. Spirit is an entirely other dimension than the four that we are aware of. Nothing made of four-dimensional material, you, me, the chair you're sitting on, the building we're in, the Bibles we're reading, the words on those pages, the physical, can ever fully describe or even reasonably contemplate that which is of the spiritual dimension. So we do the best we can. We have some understanding of God, but in reality, it's probably very little. He doesn't answer our every question. You know why? We have no capacity to ask the proper questions. We don't even have the ability to grasp all the divine answers. We struggle with what we have. Therefore, when it comes to the tabernacle and the various rituals and the procedures that are performed there, the priesthood, the biblical feasts, these things are extremely limited facsimiles demonstrating spiritual principles. So we must not ever think that the physical model is all there is, or is it fully adequate. Yet neither must we think that the physical model is incorrect, or it's not worth observing, or it's just, you see, that it's incomplete. That's really what it is. It's incomplete as compared to the spiritual object or principle that's actually being demonstrated. Now, as concerned the principle of ritual uncleanness in the camp of the Israelites, the ultimate danger and concern was that the constant uncleanness of the people would eventually defile the camp. And the camp would eventually become so defiled that God would no longer live there among his people. There was a very definite quid pro quo present. God would remain among his people only so long as his people were scrupulous in keeping the camp ritually clean. Now, let that sink in for a minute. The Israelite people, God's people, had definite obligations if they wanted God to remain in their midst. And I'm going to tell you unequivocally that that pattern of obligation to God remains, as do all of his heavenly patterns. We have obligations to God if we want him to dwell with us. These obligations may not be so much about ritual as they are about faith, especially since the advent of Yeshua. Yet as James said, a faith without works is a dead faith. What good is it? Now allow me to paraphrase that in modern terms. A so-called faith that does not produce tangible service to God by whatever means he directs is a faith that probably doesn't even actually exist. And since nearness to God is an inherently dangerous proposition, many preventative measures were being taken, beginning with a scrupulously purified priesthood who were to be the only ones that could even get near the Yahweh. Levite guards were deployed to keep these unauthorized people away, even to execute those who insisted on trying to come near. And a system of dealing with ritual purity was established that involved removing these unclean people from the area and then, in most cases, making the unclean clean again so that they could once again enjoy God's presence in their lives. This is another principle that, of course, has never become obsolete. Believers have always been required to take preventive measures so that we don't bring immorality, which is unclean behavior, near to God. And since God dwells with us, his modern-day tabernacles, we cannot allow impurity to enter us because that brings it near to him. So one of the things we're told, we can't join ourselves to prostitutes. We should not engage in any kind of immoral sex. We should not defile ourselves with wanton drunkenness. We shouldn't worship false gods. We shouldn't worship worthless symbols. We're to have the attitude of the Levites. Stay alert. Chase away every danger to the holiness of God. But humans cannot avoid impurity. And this reality traces right back to the fall of Adam and Eve. Perhaps the primary reason for Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, was so that the high priest could remove all the uncleanness from the sanctuary that had built up during the previous year. The mere fact that humans, regular Israelites, and the priests were constantly present in and around the sanctuary meant that imperfection and therefore sin and therefore uncleanness were present, and it would defile the place. Even the high priest is not seen as perfect. He was merely declared to be the holder of the high priestly office, and he was to perform certain vital functions to the service of the Lord. And we'll continue this very interesting, deep subject next time.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.